from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Now, as for Jared Kushner's security clearance being reduced, sources close to the White House are bluntly telling CNN that Chief of Staff John Kelly's move, quote, directly undercuts the president's son-in-law in his role as an envoy to the Middle East peace process.
The state of Illinois is defending its law, allowing unions to collect so-called agency fees.
There's no bigger fan of the Second Amendment than me, and there's no bigger fan of the NRA. And these guys are great patriots. They're great people. And they want to do something.
I'm not even given adequate money to buy supplies for my classroom. But now if I choose to carry a gun will be provided for me.
Why don't we take the no-fly list, a list of people who we think are, we suspect of terrorism. We don't let them fly on aircraft. Maybe we should add that to the list of people who can't buy guns in America. And if the president would address some of those more seriously, then we could take him more seriously.
Well, that might be the case if airplanes were mentioned in the Constitution, but they're not. I thought I would just complete that sentence. All right, so that was a bunch of clips. This is Colin McEnroe. John Dankosky is not with us today. I don't know if I'm supposed to say this or not, but he actually flew out to the Oscars this morning. He's out on the West Coast right now. And the reason is, and I have to whisper it this, okay, because it's not that well known. He's the guy in the fish suit in the shape of water. All right. They mentioned somebody else in the credits, but it's him. Believe me. I knew it the minute the guy got out of the tank. I thought, that's John. All right. Joining us in the studio today are Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, Liz Karantowicz. Did I do that right?
You did.
All right. Good. Liz Karantowicz. I practiced a lot. Republican political analyst, and Daniela Altomare, State House reporter at the Hartford Current. We've got lots of things to talk about. But first, let us begin. I think we should begin with the sound of yesterday's. Yesterday's was yesterday?
It ended yesterday.
It ended yesterday. That's right. 2 days ago, Andrew McDonald began a confirmation hearing, which may still be going, actually. Nobody really knows. In his bid to become the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court. He already is a justice of the Supreme Court. Let's hear a little bit of what, let me get my pointing figure out, what that sounded like.
People appear to have very different understandings of what judicial activism is. It's not a term of art in the legal community. With all due respect, it's more a popular term.
All right. So, so there's that. So, Daniela, something's happening here. Now, we should say that actually that committee vote ended in a 2020 tie. This is now moving towards the legislature where the margins are narrow. This is the kind of thing, the kind of confirmation that would have been a layup or a gimme putt in days bygone. But we knew from the confirmation of Justice Richard Palmer that these things aren't layups anymore. Although, I don't know. I've heard different working hypotheses about why this is happening. Do you have a working hypothesis?
Well, I don't necessarily have a working hypothesis.
You have a non-working hypothesis.
I would say that it really, I mean, this is a story that touches on sort of all the hot button issues of the current day, you know, important social issues like the death penalty, gay rights to some degree. It also, there's politics involved. The legislature is incredibly divided, and this is sort of the result of that. This is what you have when you have Republicans with parity in the legislature with Democrats. We haven't had that in a while. So,
Liz, is it? I mean, so there's. I think there's at least three ways to look at this. There's the one that Daniela just laid out, which is sort of kind of because we can. That's why we had to put up. We had to confirm Andrew McDonald 30-3 or something in the Senate when he went up as justice, but the margins were prohibitive at that point. There was no point in making a big fight. Now we can do this. Now we can have a fight about this. Or, as Daniela also suggested, there are certain issues that have just sort of come to the fore that just seem like they need to be thrashed out right at this minute for some reason. Or there's also this notion kind of from within the court that there's some score settling, old score settling that's going on that dates back to the confirmation of Justice Peter Zarella as Chief Justice, which never happened.
Right.
And this is like, okay, now you have to eat our dust.
Yeah, so I guess I'll just take all those things.
Take
I mean,
them all.
I think I don't think that it has much to do per se with the breakup or the makeup of the legislature. I mean, I think
you know, everyone was agreeable to Senator McDonald, Justice McDonald as a justice. I think it's different when you're appointing somebody the chief justice, right? I mean, the role there is very different. They're the head of the judicial branch. And so the concern about the political leanings becomes a little more serious than it would be, I guess, when you're just a justice. So I think there's a seriousness with which people are approaching the chief justice position, and I think that's right. I mean, the other piece of this, obviously, is that this is not new. I mean, you know, Justice Arella, he didn't even get a hearing. And Democrats completely abstained from that process. They wouldn't even give him a vote, and they wouldn't give him a vote on the floor of the legislature. So this notion that this is new politics, that this has never happened before, I mean, give me a break.
Although that was less about ideology and more about process, correct, right? There were some real questions about.
But I think this. I think you can argue that the same thing is going on here. Look at the Skakel case. What is the delay? Right. I mean, what is the delay? Why are we waiting? I mean, have they already voted? We have no idea. And so, I mean, I think you're almost looking at a very similar situation. The difference is this guy got Justice McDonald got a chance to sit and have his hearing. And whether or not they take it up for a vote is one thing. But why aren't we talking about the way that that he talked to Senator Schlossberg? I mean, you know, you talk about the fairness and the temperament and all that kind of stuff. I mean, if a Republican had dressed down a state senator in the way that he did, we'd be having that conversation.
All right, we have to contextualize this stuff. One of the other things that's emerged is that Senator Gail Schlossberg will not participate in the vote, the confirmation vote. This is something that will militate against Andrew McDonald's chances because she would ordinarily be a pretty reliable Democratic vote, one would think, on this. But there's some kind of tortured history here. What shows up is a recusal in the landmark Artie's Auto Body case.
A landmark.
I'm not entirely being serious. Although it was a really big case.
Was it?
So the case in which she asked for her husband, counsel to the Artie's Auto Body side of this, they asked for McDonald to be recused because of bad blood between them. That's the affidavit that describes this screaming, spitting, shouting, red-faced episode. The Artie's Auto Body case, Dan, because I know you like these kinds of things, it had to do with the amount of money the Hartford Insurance Group was willing to reimburse per hour to people who work in the auto body field. And it was a class action suit. It wasn't just Artie's. And they had won a $38 million lower court judgment against the Hartford, which the Hartford miraculously was able to appeal and get a unanimous reversal on the Supreme
Court. I think
you
should recuse yourself from this discussion because you were formerly sponsored by Solon Weiner in East Hartford.
Well, that is true. I remain very good friends with his son, Howard Weiner.
Yes. Yeah. Getting back to the McDonald, I think that the idea that this is a discussion on the merits of these, as near as I can tell, four or five issues that have come up: the death penalty, the church governance law that he proposed in 2009 that would have taken power away from the Catholic Church. His friendship with Malloy is really what it's about. Well, another one was Richard LaPointe. These are nonsense. This is about the fact that he's a very close friend of Dan Malloy, and this is the Republicans rising up and saying, we're going to put down Dan Malloy. That's what this is about. This is not about gay bashing, I don't believe. I haven't seen any evidence of that. I don't think this is about judicial temperance in any way, shape, manner, or form. People get into meetings and they get upset. And it was even said in the hearing, and at the time, it was like, he doesn't need to be recused because he yelled at her. Is it good that he yelled at her? Of course not. We don't like yelling in this society. But that's not a reason to not have a guy be the Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. The reason is simply because he is a friend of Dan Malloy's. That's it. And they're taking it out on him, and they're sitting him through a 13-hour hearing, and it's despicable is what it is. This is crazy. His temperament is fine. His judicial decision-making is fine. His management. The idea that he can't manage after being the chief counsel and all the stuff he's done is another ridiculous charge.
Well, I have to say, not that anybody asked me, but Daniela, it did seem to me that, like, I was troubled by the Palmer thing because I just know what Dick Palmer's record is. I mean, he's basically a very strong mainstream, left of center Supreme Court justice who's written a lot of the real actual landmark opinions of the court, the notion that that was a 1916 confirmation process I thought was political theater and kind of disgusting in the way that Dan is saying right now. I think you can kind of make the case, as Liz is saying, that the Chief Justice, although it's not a really well spelled out role, but there's an administrative function that's in there somewhere. There's some kind of leadership function. Maybe how the person works well and plays well with others. Maybe that matters in a slightly different way. I don't know.
Sure. I mean, temperament matters. And, you know, a lot of these legislators knew McDonald. They served with him. I mean, he was the co-chair of the Judiciary Committee, the very committee that he was in front of, you know, for many years. So, you know, they know him and they have a fairly good sense of him. And I think most of them worked pretty well together with him. But, you know, as Danny said, there's other circumstances. You know, there's his friendship with the governor, and there's other, you know, some of these guys. Look, I mean, you know, as far as the issues go, the death penalty probably will never be reinstated in Connecticut again, right? It's sort of settled issue. But, you know, this is the chance for those lawmakers who believe it should be to have, you know, a few moments in the sun and bring out their issues and, you know, make their case.
I've got three words for you, Governor Tim Herbst. All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, a couple things. I mean, you know, if this was really, as Dan says about his friendship with Dan Malloy, he wouldn't have passed with flying colors the first time. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous. The other thing is, as a Catholic, you know, so obviously I've got an opinion about this. I think the inability to see the separation of church and state, if it were any other religion and that he had tried to pass that kind of legislation, there would have been
marches in the streets. Okay, we have to contextualize that too. So he was behind a bill that would have granted
it was his bill.
It was his bill. Well, that's what I mean by behind a bill. Yeah, that would have granted more power to the lay. I don't remember everything about it.
It would have basically taken power away from the church to manage itself and given it to lay people. I mean, that, you know, that the government has no business getting involved in that. And it should have been a bigger issue during his first confirmation hearing. And I'm glad that it's an issue now. That's something everybody should be concerned about.
It's a fake issue. That's a ridiculous issue.
I'm sorry, Dan.
He raised a bill.
As a Catholic,
and he then
it's not a fake issue.
And said, well, maybe that's not. There was nothing unconstitutional about the bill.
I have to say.
That bill was bad judgment. It wasn't unconstitutional.
With all due respect, as a Catholic, it is not a fake issue. It really was very troubling.
But Liz, I'd like to back up and just go back to what John Kissel said yesterday. There was a press conference yesterday where the Republicans explained what their position was. John Kissel's, I don't think there was room to interpret his words differently. He said he had no problem with Andrew McDonald's behavior as a legislator. He thought that he was a great colleague,
sure.
Someone he really, well, this would include the time when he raised this
sure.
bill. He had no problems and that the Republican opposition, as he understood it, to McDonald had nothing to do with McDonald's tenure in the legislature. So if that's true, if John Kissel is telling the truth, and John Kissel has never knowingly that lied in my presence, then you'd have to take that bill off the table, right?
Well,
this is really about his behavior. I mean, the way that Kissel is saying it, he's saying the clock started running when McDonald got on the court. That's what this is all about.
Sure.
And so his behavior on the court is what's important, not his behavior as a legislator.
And I think you get back to this conversation about what happened with Zarella, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if we weren't going to give Zarella a hearing because Taco Sullivan was hiding cases, I think you can make the same argument here. The Skakel case is unprecedented in its time and how long it's taking to get through the court, correct?
I keep laughing when you say that because you're right.
Talk about Kennedy privilege, okay? Mm. Talk about Kennedy privilege. The guy is out on bond for, what are we going on, a year plus, 2 years, something like that? And I mean, how many people get that opportunity? And the court is just sitting on it? They have enough justices to take the vote. What's happening? I mean, that's a significant part of this. There is no difference between this and what happened to Jody Rell. And was it a problem? Was it political then? Were they making it politics about somebody that Jody wanted? Sure. But the you know, consternation that we're experiencing right now about this is unprecedented. It's not. Give me a break.
I said it was outrageous. I didn't say it was unprecedented. I think it's interesting that 3 weeks ago when my then colleague Neil Vigder wrote a story, saying that there may be a holdup to McDonald's nomination, and he cited two people, both of whom running for governor, Republicans, saying that they didn't want to see the nomination go forward, and the state Senate Republican President Pro Tem Len Fasano said, no, I'm with this guy. I like him, and I don't see this happening. And all of a sudden, every Republican changes. That doesn't tell you that there's been some kind of a decision decided behind closed doors. We're going to go after this guy? Of course there was.
No.
And it was based on what? It was based on an election year, and they're using Daniel Daniel.
I'm wow.
Daniel Malloy as the whatever you want to call it in this election year, and everything about him is going to be this is what we're going after. And that was the decision made presumably behind closed doors. The evidence of Len Fasano saying just 3 weeks ago, no, I don't see that happening. And then all of a sudden, every single Republican going against this nomination for no substantive reason is my
right,
view of
that. We're going to leave that topic there, although I would like to point out, just as a matter of record, that you've had dates that lasted longer than you and Neil Victor were colleagues.
Ooh.
Like, well, really, your colleagues were like 2 weeks or something, right?
2 week date. Okay. All right.
All right. So it's been complicated. There's been a lot of
It's complicated.
It's like the major league trading deadline or something. Like people are going back and forth to different teams, you know. So you guys were at Hearst together. Now he's with Daniela at the Current. Daniela, we don't have a lot of time for this, but it's probably worth noting that as the story of Parkland, Florida stretches on and becomes a different kind of national debate, inevitably eyes turn towards Connecticut. We've had the governor say a few things about gun control, and I was listening last night to National Public Radio, to All Things Considered, and there was a lengthy piece on Chris Murphy, you know, who really has maintained his position as one of the kind of thought leaders in the Senate on gun control. I mean, it's sort of interesting the way to which, at least for people who want enhanced gun legislation, Connecticut now, because of its tragic history and what came after, we're sort of a model for people to look at right now.
Yeah, and SD is calling for other states to replicate what we've done with domestic violence, you know, where people who are, you know, charged with that would have to, you know, surrender their weapons. So there's really a, you know, people in other states are looking at Connecticut, certainly, as a model.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a whole lot more to say about that, although it has been suggested that there this notion of some kind of regional compact that would involve a bunch of states with stronger gun legislation getting together to kind of form a country within a country.
Charlie Baker joined the compact, interestingly. That as a Republican, obviously a moderate Republican in a liberal Democrat state, Massachusetts, but it's starting to be more than just the usual cabal of Cuomo and Malloy. And this is what the Constitution envisions. You know, states do things on their own and getting together, and it's a more or less healthy process. I disagree with something that Senator Murphy said, where he said that there's not a tipping point, that it's a gradual buildup. And I think this could be more of a tipping point. Just this morning, there was news that Dick's Sporting Goods is no longer going to be selling so-called black rifles or military-style rifles. That was Walmart had already done that based on business reasons, but that was Dick's Sporting Goods. And also not selling guns to people under 21. So you're starting to see a lot of organic changes here. The credit card sponsorships of the NRA, the rental cars, the flap in Georgia between the Senate president and Delta Airlines. Delta stopped a promotion with the NRA. These are things that rise up when there is a tipping point, and there may be one here, although I think the Democrats have to be careful because the bans on the equipment are not going to happen. And by pushing themselves so far to holding a position intractably that can't happen, they give up the opportunity to make things happen on the margins, like real tighter background checks, not just fixing the federal FBI system. And so they could get more done if they were slightly less strident.
Yeah, there's a lot of push and pull, particularly yes. about the NICS,
yes.
the so-called Fix the NICS bill. But I'm also wondering, Liz, what kind of issue in Connecticut this turns into during an election year that has no clear front runners and stuff like that. Do guns become a different kind of issue in Connecticut?
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, just to agree with Dan, I mean, I do think this is a tipping point. And I think that a lot of the organic changes that you're seeing, I mean, I talked to folks from not the NRA, but the National Sports Shooting Foundation, and they're advocating for tighter restrictions and to make sure that their members, their legal gun owners are protected. And the way to do that is to make sure that you have restrictions on who can't have a weapon. And so, you know, is it a political issue? I think it will be. I think it always is. I think it's a question that's been asked frequently at the debates that Republicans have had. I seem to take away from those that there's a sort of a unified position in some ways, and not, I don't know that how far that aligns with, you know, kind of where voters are, which is could be difficult. But, you know, I think it will be an issue because it's an ongoing problem, unfortunately.
All right. So we're going to take a little break here. When we come back, we're going to tell the story of how Dan Harr fell in love with a fiscal panel that could never love him back. That's not really exactly what we're going to talk about, but that's close enough. All right, welcome back to The Wheelhouse. Also, we have our friends from CTN in here with us. I would have showered if I'd known they were coming, but all the same, I think you're going to see. We're on right after, one of the new dramatic series that they've gone on, which is Dr. Prasad Srinivasan is the good doctor who's somehow opposed to gun control laws.
Colin, I'm going to usurp the high honor of asking you what's on your show today.
Yes, John does usually do that right at this point. My show today is about slime. All I can tell you is if you're not thinking enough about slime. Slime is a much bigger topic and a more diverse topic, and that's all I'm going to say about it.
Slime with like Mary Nickelodeon Roach. Slime?
All kinds okay. of slime, but not excluding Nickelodeon slime. That's a generational thing. Dan Harr, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, Liz Karantowicz, Republican political analyst, and Daniela Altamare, State House reporter at the Hartford Courant, are here. You know, I haven't had to consult my notes, the outline for this show, all day, but I have to look at them now just because I can't remember the name of this thing. But yes, they are chaired by a reclusive Austrian prince. They drink human blood at their meetings. Connecticut has its own Bilderberg group. They are called the Commission on Fiscal Sustainability and Economic Growth. Why couldn't I not remember that name? It's just like rolls off the tongue.
If each of the chairmen gives $100,000 to the nonprofit affiliated with the commission,
Connecticut Rising,
does that exonerate their evil?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. That's like the kind of no. Well,
I love these guys.
Wow. We're joking.
I'm talking about his thing. I love these guys.
No, he does. He does. Let's start here. That you do love this panel. We should say first of all that this is a group. They are here to save us, right? They are here to save us from our fiscal emergency. They are going to issue their findings tomorrow, I believe.
They're going to vote on their findings.
They're going to vote on their findings. Will they vote on their findings, but then issue them tomorrow?
They're going to vote, then issue. Or they may issue, then vote.
Is that a public
it's
vote?
It's a public vote. Is a public commission. Yes.
No, I know that, but I didn't know.
Yes, it's a public.
Well, that's been sort of a sticky issue, too, but we'll get
yes,
to that. We'll get to that. So since you're in love with this commission, you've had this big man crush on this commission from day one. It's because it's like right up your alley.
It is.
Cue romantic music.
It's up my alley. It's also up Oz Griebel's alley, too, as a candidate, because this is a nonpartisan effort to try and say, look, what are the structural issues that are preventing us from, A, balancing budgets, and, B, having growth? And as we all know here, and I think most of the listeners know, that Connecticut has this giant catch-22, which is that if you cut expenses and don't spend money investing in the things you need to invest in, cities, highways, training, people, all that sort of thing, you can't grow as a state. And if you spend all that money, you have to raise taxes and you can't grow as a state. So this is what they're attempting to do. And they're going to come out with some things that both sides of the political aisle are not going to like. They are likely to come up with the idea of tightening some, I'm looking at Liz, some collective bargaining processes, especially at the municipal level. That's likely. They're also likely.
Look, you look over at Daniela for this one.
And they're also, they're also likely to come up with some additional revenue, which includes probably tolls, if I were to guess, and almost definitely to back the increase in the gas tax.
I thought they were going to like cut the income tax and raise the sales tax or
something.
They also are going to cut some nominal tax rates, although I don't know what they are. I don't have any inside information on that. I have been told by a prominent member of the commission, which is to say a member of the commission, since they're all
they're
prominent.
They're all extremely prominent.
They're all prominent.
Extremely
just
prominent.
So this commission includes five current or recent CEOs, including the CEOs of the Hartford and Stanley Black & Decker and Webster Bank. But they are going to propose revenue neutral overall. And so if they propose increases in revenue, they're going to propose. That's what I've been told. How true that is, we'll see because it's an open vote.
Well, now, we're going to backtrack and look a little bit about some of the processes here, just because it's really funny mainly. But Daniela, I don't know. I mean, there's like blue ribbon panels all the time. They can make any recommendation they want. What's the likelihood that this thing just gets filed on some dusty shelf somewhere and nobody does anything about it?
I would guess the likelihood is pretty high. I mean,
don't tell them that. They've got their little hearts set on this.
I don't know. Maybe you know. Look, we're going to have an election, and we're going to have a new governor, and we're going to have some changes in the legislature for sure. So, you know, we'll see what they do with it. But I don't know. Like you said, there's been.
Could you try to act a little bit more enthusiastic? These poor CEOs, they're so excited about this.
I think we're desperate enough to listen to a blue ribbon panel. I really do.
It may be that the problem is of such magnitude that we'll, you know, things that would have been put on a shelf before will have to be looked at because we got no other choice.
Well, so, yes, Liz, they are articulating one way of looking at this. Both of them are now, which is that why not listen to somebody else? I mean, if they, by some miracle, have lightning in a bottle, I mean, we could really use that.
Well, and it could be, for some folks, a way of saying, well, you know, we just did what the commission said, right? Mm-hmm. So we didn't, you know, I mean, you could look at it from that perspective if you wanted to. But, you know, look, I mean, I think we have to wait and see what they say. And it remains to be seen. I know that they're, part of their requirement is they get a vote out of committee. Correct. And the speaker said that, you know, we'll hear them out in committee. No commitment of a vote on the floor. The Democrats are in charge in that building from top to bottom. And so, you know, to the extent that we get to hear or take a, you know, public position on any of these things, that's in the hands of the people in charge.
Well, although that's pretty I knew that they were guaranteed something. So they get guaranteed a vote in finance, revenue, and bonding their proposal?
They get a vote out of committee at least, I believe.
Interestingly, the phrase in the statute, which was part of the budget last year creating this commission, says that they do get a vote on their proposals as amended by the committee process.
Oh.
So it could. There's a little bit of a loophole there, but I think everybody in the spirit of this believes that these proposals are going to at least get hearings and one hopes actual votes.
So I have to talk to you about your sick fascination with this committee. And No, I'm not. Well, first of all, one of the things that arose as an issue is what kind of thing is this? Because it turns out that when you get a bunch of CEOs together, what they don't do is say, all right, so Don, you pick up some of those really good apple turnovers they have at that Puerto Rican bakery there on Prospect, and Bob, you go over and get like some of those big jugs of Dunkin' Donuts coffee, and we'll just grab a meeting room somewhere and, you know, and sort of hash all this stuff out. For some reason or other, they've needed $300,000 to do what? What do they need $300,000 for?
Well, what they said they spent the money on is a report by McKinsey & Company, which is, of course, management consulting group, which does a lot of public sector work. They brought in a consultant by the name of Jim Milstein, who was the chief negotiator in the bailout, one of the chief negotiators for the Treasury Department under Obama in 2009. He is suggesting a move of the lottery corporation into the state treasury, which I won't go into, but there's magic dust there that saves hundreds of millions of dollars. They paid a public affairs consultant and a PR firm. So, you know, all that money has to go somewhere, and here it is.
What do they need a PR firm for? Why can't they just give their findings to the, you know, I mean, the legislature has plenty of communications people. The governor's office has plenty of communications people. Well, some what do they need a PR firm for?
Some of us have trouble going to the CGA website and finding the agendas.
Well, people could, like Larry Cook will send you an email, tell you when they're meeting. One thing that we should say about this, Danielle, is this is the kind of thing that will get the hackles up on certain groups of people over the Capitol. I think the state employees unions are very nervous about what's coming down the pike from this. And some of the sort of common cause CCAG people, they were particularly upset when initially there was this kind of parallel nonprofit called Connecticut Rising that was formed to collect some of this money so they'd have lots of money to spend and they wouldn't say who the donors were. And I mean, this kind of thing, it's not even a quasi-public agency. It's a God knows what kind of animal this is. And there are some people at the Capitol who are immediately getting nervous. Is this big business ramming some stuff down our throats without anything resembling legislative process?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, you're right. Labor is very nervous. You know, they're nervous about the process, and they're also nervous about the, you know, the specifics of what's going to be proposed.
I don't know. I mean, I'm looking back at Liz here. One thing that I'll say, just to get into an argument with you.
good. Pick a fight. Yeah.
I think that one of the great myths is that business is super efficient and government is super inefficient. I think they're both kind of inefficient, but in different ways. You know, the fact that they need $300,000 to do God knows what to, they're like a bunch of experts. We got like a whole bunch of experts, like the best experts we could get. That's who they were, right? This bunch of CEOs who run all these great companies and they're really smart. It turns they have to spend $300,000 finding people to come in and tell them stuff. I thought the whole idea was they knew stuff. But I actually think one of the myths is that business is streamlined and efficient, and government isn't. I've just never bought that. You know, I think, as I say, they're inefficient in different ways. I mean, what does business really have? What can they really tell us about how to have a more efficient, streamlined government?
Well, I don't. So, full disclosure, I really don't know much about any of the, besides what I've read. You know, Christine Stewart has put some pieces out, especially about, you know, sort of the nonprofit that they started and stuff. So, I'm only guessing here based on what I've read, nothing beyond that. But I think, you know, sometimes the strength is knowing what you don't know. You know, I mean, you get in a room and you have a lot of questions. I think better for them to go and say, you know, well, let's have McKinsey look at this, you know, and we're not going to make the state pay for it. And so to that extent, you've got to go out and fact check, and you want to provide impartial data that's not part of the, you know, the setup that you have. So maybe that's where they were coming from on that. I don't think they should be concerned about their participation in the process. They're a bipartisan group.
Or nonpartisan.
Nonpartisan, yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, these are folks that, you know, have sort of been involved in the process and they're sitting listening. You know, the speaker had an opportunity to put anybody on the commission that he wanted. He represents labor, mm-hmm. And he could have put a labor representative on if he wanted to, but he didn't. Now, the cynic in me says maybe they didn't do that so they could make these kinds of claims that they're making about not having a seat at the table. Although with the speaker being an employee of AFSCME, I don't think anybody can argue that labor doesn't have a seat at the table every day.
That's actually what he said. When I asked him why he didn't appoint a labor representative, he said to me the words, "Labor is very well represented in this building."
So there you go.
And he's not wrong.
Yeah. No. So there you go. So I think, you know, that what the commission finds, what they recommend, you know, I think there shouldn't be a concern about where they're coming from. I think they've all been put on that commission by a bipartisan group of lawmakers. And so their findings will be what they are. I mean, I don't know that there's any sort of nefarious intent here.
Oh, I don't think there's any nefarious. First of all, I should say that there's some incredibly, wonderfully public-spirited people on this commission, including Liz and I have a very good friend, Greg Butler, is on this commission. You know, a lot of people who are just wonderful benefactors to all kinds of organizations, including Connecticut Public Broadcasting,
right,
when you get right down to it. So you know, I'm sure they're all terrific people. I just wonder, Dan, you know, I know how excited you must be about their findings, but I mean, I wonder if this goes anywhere.
Well, so, you know, like I said, joking before, that we're desperate enough to listen to them. There has been a point at which people have thrown their hands up collectively in the Capitol and said, we can't solve these problems. And so having a group like this is an opportune time for that. But I want to go back to this donation issue, because this raises a really big question. Mm-hmm. And to go back to what happened, Christine Stewart at CT News Junkie wrote a story establishing that Bob Patricelli, the co-chairman, who recently retired from the third healthcare company that he founded, has a family foundation. He donated $100,000 initially. He formed a nonprofit group to affiliate, to assist this commission before the first meeting. after the commission was named, but before the first meeting, Jim Smith, the former CEO of Webster Financial, the parent of Webster Bank, presumably has some control over the Webster Foundation. That gave $100,000. Yale gave $100,000.
Because Bruce Alexander's
Bruce Alexander. I was just going to say, yes, a vice president of Yale who's on the commission. And so the question arises when very well-meaning people who are, as you just said, you know, altruistic. This is not an anti-government bunch. I've sat through, listened to most of the commission's meetings. I went to Cancun with the commission for 2 weeks, as you know.
That was purely social, though.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was a long day.
So they needed you for their volleyball team.
That's exactly right. Yes, shirtless volleyball.
I'm thinking that scene from Top Gun.
Oh yeah. So this is not an anti-government attack on anything. This is a nonpartisan group of people who want to help the state where they want their companies to remain and thrive. That's what this is. The question is, can you have a government? This is not a quasi-public. This is a legislative commission.
Creature of legislation.
This is public. This isn't quasi-anything. And so can you have it such that they are allowed to donate money to themselves? It's a great gesture. It may not be the right thing to do, and it raises a terrific question. If the commission does better with the consulting, that forget the PR firm and all that stuff, but if they do better with a McKinsey report than they would have without it,
Dewey McDowell about this.
Then is it for the better that they donated money, or does it raise questions about what commissions are going to look like in the future? I think it's a great issue.
All right, we're going to have to stop there, so we'll have time for our final segment, where of course everybody always wants to know what. What's happening at Stratford? Stratford's such a bellwether for Connecticut. We'll tell you that. And Daniela has had a great article, too, about how women kind of, what kind of profile they cut in the gubernatorial race and whether there might be some element of sexism occasionally cropping up. And we're back. This is The Wheelhouse. Right about now, I should thank somebody. I'm looking in my notes. I think I'll just thank people from the heart. So Scott Breedy is here producing. So is the big kid, Katie Tularski, and Kyone Wolf is on the board. Garnett McLaughlin's our amazing intern. And there's probably some other people I should thank, too. Just whoever they are, just type their names in the chat field. But anyway, those are like the key people that I'm aware of. So thanks to all of you, and thanks also to this great panel. We've got one more segment to go. Dan Haar, Liz Karantowicz, and Daniela Altomare. So Daniela, there's like nothing more exciting than a special election in Stratford, Connecticut. So what happened in this special election?
Well, I guess over 40 years, the Republicans have held that seat, and the Democrats won yesterday. So, you know, there's national, you know, all the indivisible groups and all the resistance, Trump's resistance groups are, you know, claiming this is a sign, this is a harbinger of a blue wave, this is, you know, this is a message that people in this district are sending to Washington. You know, the Republicans are saying this is an election with a, you know, 17-19% turnout. It doesn't mean anything. So take it where you want.
I don't know,
Thanks
Liz.
Thanks for that setup.
But I think it doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything. It was a 52-vote margin. Here's what's concerning. This is sort of a follow-on from some of the lack of enthusiasm in the municipal elections. And so, you know, obviously we always prefer to win than lose. The one good thing about losing is that you get to take stock of what happened and make a course correction. The indivisible groups, the ACT-CT, all those guys, they should take credit. You know, they got their people out, they knocked on the doors, and they made phone calls. And that's how you win special elections. I will remind everybody that Len Susio won a special election in 2011 and then went on to lose the general in November of 2012. It was a very similar time frame. So I don't know that it's necessarily an indicator of anything other than that they did a better job turning out their vote. And it is, I mean, look, if the turnout had been 50%, then I think you can say, oh, we're really onto something here. There's this wave. But turnout was 17%. I mean, I don't think you can surmise anything from that except for the fact that Democrats did a better job turning out their vote because they're more excited. That's it.
But isn't that a problem?
Democrats
are more excited.
Oh, I'm not saying it's not a problem. I'm saying it's a problem, and it's a problem that Republicans are going to have to solve if we're going to win elections in November. So I'm not, you know, that clearly it's an issue. But when you know what the problem is, you can try and do something to fix it.
Liz, you don't have to remind anybody about the political career of Len Susio. I mean, come on. Just like people know that.
I'm with Liz on this one. There, he got 1,615 votes, of which I would surmise it being a local election or a state election for a local office. I said it backwards again. I would surmise that more than half those people know him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really not a bellwether, I don't think. But, you know, it's
yes.
There are 80 people on that town committee.
Yeah. Elections in small towns
town. You know, I mean, and that's what it comes down to. This comes down to motivating the base, making sure people are out there making phone calls and taking nothing for granted. I mean, you look at the special election from Senator Berthel last year in March, I think it was. You know, Democrats came loaded for bear on that one. And, you know, we were able to stave them off. But, you know, you really have to get people out. And it's hard. It's hard any time of year. It's really hard in February. These are not excuses. This is, you got to take a hard look at it and you got to go, okay, what are we going to do? We've got time to figure this out. But special elections are tough. And, you know, they had Blumenthal down there. They had Murphy down there. They had Delora down there. They have the ability to, you know, wield their stars, as it were, and I put that in air quotes, to get down and motivate people to go out and make phone calls. I mean, who wouldn't love to go make calls with the Murph, right?
Right. Oh,
so
yeah. I would do that.
So I think we've got to figure it out. I mean, and we had some of our gubernatorial candidates were down there knocking doors and making calls, but not all of them. And you know, we got to get this figured out.
You know, I could talk about Stratford all day, but
I'm
think
sure
we're done.
You could.
I think we're done. As I mentioned before, Danielle, you wrote a very interesting article this week about women in the gubernatorial race, of which there are not many, we have to say, and Dina Bargava having dropped down a line.
Technically, there are none, because the only women that are, quote-unquote, running are exploratory candidates.
Is Bysewitz still in an exploratory?
I believe she's exploratory for governor.
Well, really? Because she went. Yeah. She had the whole thing when she went to the Secretary of State's office and
I'm
filed
so
papers of some kind, right?
This. Yeah.
I am too. I sort of feel like, I mean, I'm glad you're making that point, although my personal philosophy is if you're raising money and running around bothering people and showing up at debates and making a nuisance of yourself, then you're running. I don't really care whether you say you're exploratory.
Elections
or
enforcement's going to have a field day with that declaratory, whether or not she made some sort of a declaratory statement. Anyway.
But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. What are we here to talk about?
Well, I just, you know, this is, quote unquote, the year of the woman. And, you know, there's all this activism, as we just talked about before, you know, with these new groups, the women's march groups and some of these other groups. And yet, you know, there's vast field of candidates on both sides running for governor. And there are fairly not that many women. So why is that? What kind of barriers do women candidates face that men don't? And, you know, that's sort of what we got to look at.
Well, I mean, in your article, I mean, you cited sort of the way women are talked about sometimes on talk radio, although what Will Marotti and Jim Vicevich have to say about women may not be representative of, you know, even like Homo sapiens, but also just kind of, you know, but they were sort of being, oh, there were callers, right, who were being dismissive of Aaron Stewart, of her kind of uptalky Valley girl speaking way. Of course, we talked last week about the fact that because they're exploratory candidates, neither she nor Tony Boucher could get on the debate stage. And then on the Democratic side, I mean, Susan Bysewitz is the only contender in the field, right?
The only female.
Female contender, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you hear, you know, you hear a lot of things about her. Bysewitch, people say, you know, what's that all about? I mean, you know, there are a lot of undercurrents here.
Now, wait a minute.
Yeah, there's some terrible double standards in the political world. And it is difficult to recruit women to run because I think of how personal it is when you're talking to potential candidates or when you're working with women elected officials. You know, I think there is a double standard. We've talked about Aaron's age a few times, Mayor Stewart, on this show. She's 31.
I think she just turned
30. But Art Linares was just 30. And his age was never brought up. It's one of those things that does, you sort of talked about Daniela's story. That's exactly what you're talking about. This notion that, you know, there's sort of a double standard and it is difficult.
Go ahead.
I'm not sure, just as a momentary aside here, why we're allowed to talk about personal animosity towards Susan Bysewitz, but not personal animosity towards Andrew McDonald. That's another.
But I think that the point that's being raised here, Danny, is that, you know, that with Bicewicz, the question is, she's often described as like just super aggressive, right? You know, and
good for
and,
her.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. If you're aggressive and opportunistic and you're a man, you get defined one way. And the argument goes, if you're aggressive and opportunistic as a woman, you start getting like which words
fair,
attached.
Fair
attached
point.
To.
Undercutting the seemingly logical argument that there's something in respect to gender politics going on here is the fact that there are two women, either of whom could have been the nominee of their party, who elected not to run, who decided not to run. And that's Lieutenant Governor Nancy Wyman and, of course, the Republican leader of the House, Themis Claridis. Themis could be governor. Mm-hmm. If she could wait today, tomorrow's March 1st. She could wake up tomorrow, March 1st, 2 weeks and 2 months from the convention, and decide she wants to be governor. And she will, not might, she will be the next governor of Connecticut if she wants. She could walk into the race.
And
no,
you know,
Democrat can beat her. Sorry to agree with.
Speaking of which, is what is this, right? Macbeth or something?
Yeah. So right. So exactly. So she decided not to run, as did Lieutenant Governor Nancy Wyman. They decided not to run. Nobody put a gun to their heads and said, "This is a male-dominated system."
But
here.
You know that if Representative Claridis decided to run, there would be a certain element within either among reporters or among bloggers or whoever, former WWE ring girl gets elected governor. I mean, you know that. That would be out there.
That happens all the time.
Yeah.
Who did it last time? Was it August Wolf? Or was there somebody like that? Was it August Wolf? Yeah. He posted a picture of Themis in her old WWE outfit, and I immediately shared it on Facebook and said, you know, he just locked up the 14-year-old boy vote for Themis Claridis. I mean, there's like, you know, they're all going to be showing up to volunteer for her. But I agree that, you know,
she's smarter. Listen, she's smarter than all but one person at this table.
I don't know if she's the Thane of Cawdor quite at the level that you've ordained her, but I don't know.
I don't disagree with the thing you said.
You think if she declared, she'd be the next governor?
I mean, I don't know about right now, but that's neither here nor there. I think that
she's not gonna
the decision-making process, you can't undercut, though. It is a different decision-making process for women, and I'm not, you know, I'm not saying that that it wasn't their decision to make, but it is a different decision-making process. And when you're talking to potential women candidates, a lot of the things that Daniela brought up in her article are the sort of things that you face. And it's the same stuff that Aaron Stewart has faced. It's the same stuff that Susan Bicewicz faced. It's the same stuff that Governor Rell faced. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, things have not changed that much in this process. We're grateful that we've got 22 women in the House Republican caucus, the most in the state, and frankly, more than Paul Ryan has. And that's a testament to Themis's ability to go out and get women to run for office. And so, you know, I mean, it is a difficult process, and it's something that for all potential candidates, there's just something different about the way women make decisions. I think that in some cases, you know, we sort of bring things to their logical conclusion, and that it takes, you know, we've got that iterative process a little bit more. And I think sometimes, in my experience, men are more willing to charge up the hill without thinking. And so I think that can be a part of it. But I do think that there is still an undercurrent of you know, sort of double standards that women have to face. And it does make things a little bit more difficult. And to discredit that, it you know, they came to their own decisions, but they did that not in a vacuum.
We're sort of running out of time here, but maybe we can just take a minute or so to mention the fact that Jonathan Harris now is no longer exploratory. We have kind of the Democratic field is shaping up, although during the break I think we all have slightly different takes about how that shakes out as they head towards a convention. I don't know. I mean, he announced on Saturday. Danielle, a quick take on Jonathan and his chances?
I don't know what his chances are. I mean, he's clearly, this is something he's been wanting for a very long time. As Beth Bye noted in his the day he announced, his email address has been Govern Connecticut 1 for, you know, 2 decades. So he's clearly very ambitious. Where is his opening? I don't know. Danny, you're He's rubbing your hands together.
He's been said to be not a rousing speaker, but I did go to the forum in Glastonbury last week, and he was much more strong voiced and rousing, and that made
me. Were you roused?
I was not as much as with the commission.
Hot take.
I think his video was hysterical. Going to all of the companies that have been have left Connecticut during the tenure of the governor that he was helped to elect. To me, I thought that was terrific.
All right, we got to stop there. Thanks to Liz and Dan and Daniela, and thanks to our whole crew here. John will be back. We'll all be so happy when John is back next week. Nobody happier than me. Thanks for listening.